ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
If you woke up tomorrow and found yourself Prime Minister, what would you do? How would you run Australia? What's your plan for energy, for housing, for the economy? The Economy Stupid has a three-part series talking about what Australia could become if we had the courage to choose it. Search for The Economy Stupid and look out for Choose Your Own Australia. Find it where you get your podcasts and the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. It's summer on ABC Radio National, so I'm bringing you some of your favourite stories from the year gone by. And today we're diving into family relationships. During the holiday season, those ties can feel more tangled and more telling than ever. They're fraught with complexities, but probably some of the deepest and most intimate connections that many of us will ever have. Coming up, one woman's fight to pull her husband from the depths of addiction, and a so-called reproductive refugee who fled her home state to create her own family and make her dream of motherhood come true. But first, two of the world's top models, the Hadid sisters, Gigi and Bella, confirmed earlier this year that their family had been keeping a secret. The sisters revealed that they have a younger half-sibling after their father had a relationship with another woman more than 20 years ago. And they're not the only celebrities whose families have had secrets. Mariska Hargitay, who's probably most famous for her role on the TV show Law & Order SVU, also shared that the man who raised her was not her biological father. The actress told Vanity Fair she grappled with knowing I'm living a lie my entire life. So yeah, family life, it involves lots of twists and tangles. The full facts of our lives aren't always shared with the world or with each other. So why do families keep secrets and what makes people finally reveal the truth? I'm joined by filmmaker Sue Goldfish, who was a teenager when she discovered a family secret that changed her life, and Ashley Barnwell, who investigates inherited family secrets. She's an associate professor in sociology at the University of Melbourne. Sue, I'd like to start with you. You grew up believing you were an only child.
Yes. I had a really tiny family. It was just me and my mum and dad. And I grew up in Trinidad in the West Indies, which should have been a clue. Okay. Something was interesting was afoot. But, you know, you're a child. You just accept where you are. When we came to Australia, things changed. I was 14 when we got here and I, you know, went off to school. And the first thing that happened in the kind of unravelling of the family secret was that I was asked to bring my birth certificate to school. So my mother said, go and look over here, you know, it's in a box. And I went through the box and I found something that I thought was my birth certificate, but it was my parents' marriage certificate. And next to my father's name was the word divorced.
Oh, okay. And that was a shock to start for you?
No idea. So I was enraged, as any 14-year-old would be, that, you know, my parents had this, I don't know, just this sense of another life, you know, that I had no idea about. And I confronted them. It was like breakfast. I kind of remember it quite well. And my parents just looked at each other in complete horror because they knew that something was becoming unraveled. And my mother, who I think protected my father a lot, just said, you know, this is none of your business. And I went, excuse me, are there children from this other family? And, you know, my father says, yes, there is actually two children. And I want to know where they are, and he says he doesn't know.
Wow. I can only imagine how 14-year-old you received that comment from your mum saying this is none of your business when you're learning that you maybe have siblings somewhere. That's crazy.
Exactly. Triple enraged. Unbelievable. But it's the start of something. It's the thing around the secret in my family, and I know there's differences, you know, in different experiences for people, but mine was like a blanket of silence. So every time they had to admit to something, it would be as minimal as possible.
So you're really kind of scrounging breadcrumbs, trying to piece this thing together. You eventually discover you have a brother and sister that were living halfway around the world.
Yeah, my dad said that he thought they lived in Canada. And in fact, when I was still a teenager, I went to the Canadian consulate and actually went looking through their phone books for another goldfish, thinking that maybe I could find them. But the way that I eventually found them is that my half-brother sent my father a book that he'd written. So part of the secret was that he did have some connection with them, but he just wasn't sharing it with me. So this book arrives and my father makes the decision to show me, and I see that the name on the book is actually not Goldfish, it's Wagshall, so they have the name of their stepfather. And I write back to Harry, you know, going, I've read your book, it's amazing, it's all about education and it's wonderful and I'd really like to meet you. And he doesn't write back. And again, everything lapses and I think, oh, this is just never going to happen. But when I'm 30, in my 30s, a young man turns up in Sydney and he's my father's grandson. And similarly, he also has been trying to track down his grandfather, his real grandfather, while I'm trying to track down my half-brother and sister. And the coming together of my nephew, Jerry, and me and my family is finally when I make connection with my half-brother and sister. And, you know, I'm still, it's just the best and most wonderful thing that could have happened.
That's really beautiful. You grew up thinking you're an only child. You've managed to find this large extended family in time.
Yeah.
What did your dad think about all this?
He, you know, he obviously was very reticent about revealing all of these parts of his life that he'd left behind, which I think, you know, he'd done very thoroughly. He'd kind of drawn a line, and I was part of his new life, and all of these other people and stories were part of his old life that he obviously didn't want to revisit. But when Jerry turned up, Manfred was just over the moon. He said, you know, he felt like his life had started again and that all these pieces were coming back together. The next thing that happened for him, and it was many years later, his daughter, who he hadn't seen since she was 8, came to Sydney and met him. And again, he was really, I don't know, emotional and, you know, you've made me the happiest old man and... Aww. Just the reconnection and the putting together of the pieces, yeah, made a big deal for him, yeah.
It sounds like the beginning of this story was really hard for you to deal with, but it's had a really happy ending, which I think a lot of families don't necessarily get.
Yeah. I think that's the thing. It's always a risk going into those kinds of searches, but I feel like there's always one person in the family who is driven to find out sort of more detail or the kind of richness of detail of people's lives and their connections, because it's not just finding someone, it's understanding the context of the rupture, understanding the context of, you know, all the political things that were going on that meant, you know, that Manfred ended up in Trinidad, big political things to do with world wars and then on the other hand, this kind of personal trauma of, you know, his first relationship ending and then saying goodbye to his children and never seeing them again.
Mm. Ashley Barnwell, you're a sociologist, you're researching family histories, sitting here listening to Sue's story, and it feels like it's almost beat for beat what you're discovering when you're talking to lots of families as part of your research.
I've been totally wrapped here listening to Sue's incredible story. And it does chime with so many of the stories that I've been hearing from people who are doing family history research, just stumbling upon things, often not really like Sue finding this certificate, not really being out to look for something, but then coming upon it and thinking, wow, this has really changed who I've thought that I was before.
When you were doing your research in family histories, you found that people kept mentioning family secrets during your research. What kind of secrets are people keeping normally?
I found secrets were very often about personal life. They were things that people felt that they couldn't share. But one of the amazing things I found is that all families really have the same secrets, which I found fascinating because everybody is working so hard to keep them. But there's these similar genres of secrets that families have. So there might be about reproduction, illegitimacy, who you fall in love with if you're, you know, socially not meant to fall in love with that person. Different secrets, yeah.
It's so interesting you say that because on the text line, there are people telling stories about paternity, really similar to Sue's story. One person says, my father died a while back. Before he did, he told me my sister was fathered by another man. My sister recently confirmed this. It's been troubling me since. I can't speak to my mother about it as she's unwell. Apparently, extended family were aware and my sister has said she was treated differently as a result, which must be heartbreaking. Another person says, I'm the parent of a young child who has two siblings she's never met. Not long after we had my daughter, her father and I split up and he quickly started a new relationship and had two other kids. Sadly, due to a huge family rift between myself and her father and his new partner, all contact ceased. I've told my daughter that these two children exist, but I haven't revealed their names. Ashley, who are the people who are keeping the secrets and who are the people who are revealing secrets in families?
Yeah, this has been a fascinating one. I think you find, you know, that often people will take their secrets to the grave. So there's cases where people don't tell a secret, and oftentimes people who are finding these things are finding them in records that tell them a different story than the one that they've grown up hearing at home. But one of the things I found that was very interesting going through my data and looking at the different examples of who people said they found out the secret from, I've found very often that it was aunties.
Yeah, that tracks.
Yeah, and it was auntie. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. And it wasn't just that sort of stereotype of the maiden aunt or aunt that didn't have their own children, who are often people who really have a huge legacy in a family of keeping family history and keeping all the details of the family. But it was also women that had their own children would be likely to tell their nieces and nephews things that they didn't tell their own kids. So aunties seem to play a really important role in families as secret keepers, but also that person that would sort of choose the right moment to maybe pull you aside and let you know a little bit of something that you didn't know before.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, and I'm asking if you've ever learned or revealed a family secret. We're hearing from Sue Goldfish, who discovered a family secret that she's made a film about, and Ashley Barnwell, who's a sociologist who's researching family histories and keeps finding secrets along the way. And so many people texting in. Casey says, of course parents keep secrets from their children, even grown-up ones. People have different values, and children, even adult ones, can be very judgmental. There are good reasons not to involve children in parental relationship issues such as infidelity. These issues need to be dealt with by parents alone out of respect to each other. Another person says, a topic close to my heart. My husband's sister has three children, all adults now. They were all conceived by donor sperm, but we don't know if they were ever told, and we were asked not to speak about it. I feel I have knowledge that the children, adults now, don't have. One has a child on the way, and it's on my mind. My sister-in-law is very secretive about many things, and I don't want to have this knowledge if her children don't know. Well, Ashley, you're writing a book to help families navigate secrets. Can you tell me about some of your tips that you're going to share there?
Yeah, so I've been working on a book that's a little bit like a guidebook with Dr. Alex Mountain, who's an archivist at the Society for Australian Genealogists in Sydney. And so she and I both work really closely with people who are going through this process, who have found a secret and are trying to navigate it. And what we've heard from people over and over again is that they feel quite alone sometimes in this journey of having discovered a secret and then being suddenly thrown into having to figure out the best, most ethical way to deal with that. You know, how to go about it in a way that's not going to hurt other family members, but also isn't keeping things from people if that could be hurtful as well. And so we've been putting together, I guess, strategies that people who have been through this have found before, you know, what to do, how to find out if a secret is truly, how to verify it, and then how to broach the topic and who's the right person to tell and when is the right time, which can be really difficult things for people to work out.
Hopefully all the aunties out there read your books. Sue, you made a documentary about your family, as I said before. It's called The Last Goldfish, which is such a beautiful title. What do you think your dad would think about you sharing this story with everyone, given that it was kept a secret for such a long time?
I think he'd disagree with a lot of it. He'd probably say, that's not true, and, you know, stuff like that. But I also think he'd be really proud. Before he died, I did a little short piece that was called Point of Departure, and it was just a little exercise, but it was a way of getting him to start talking to me about old photographs that he still had that were nameless. So I was trying to get him to tell stories about these photographs, and I tricked him into doing this little video with me by saying that I wanted to talk about cameras and photography and his interest in photography and home movies and things like that. And he really started to open up, and a lot of that footage from that last interview that I did with him in his 80s is really core to the film in terms of revealing his fragility and his anguish over the history that he had tried to leave behind. Because the other thing with him, he not only was leaving a family behind, he was leaving a whole identity. Mm. He didn't tell me he was Jewish. He didn't tell me anything about escaping Nazi Germany. You know, he'd been in a work camp. He'd kind of escaped with his life and all that stuff. I think, you know, just if he'd said to me, I had another family, you know, I've got these two other children, it would have opened up that whole painful, traumatic history. And I think that in our family, that was the thing that was stopping him, because he knew if he said one thing that it would lead somewhere very dark and very, you know, horrible and terrifying, because he lost most of his family. But his ability to keep that so close, it was, I don't know how he did it. I don't know if it's because he shared that sorrow with my mother. I think they were a team. I hope so. But that was the risk of undoing all the secrets, was bringing up this kind of traumatic earlier life of his.
Sue, thank you so much for sharing your story. That was filmmaker Sue Goldfish. And you also heard from Ashley Barnwell, an associate professor in sociology at the University of Melbourne, who investigates family secrets. Next on Life Matters, a story of a couple who grappled with addiction in their marriage in a time that was meant to be a beautiful transition.
Christopher Skase wasn't your typical entrepreneur.
Christopher had the most beautiful hair.
Incredibly boyish good looks.
And with his wife Pixie, they became
the story of Australia. The billionaires, the extravagance.
The Skases had it all. Until they didn't.
They'd gone from the it couple to persona non grata.
I'm Mark Humphreys. To binge the full series now, search for ABC Rewind and look for Skase, Fall of a Tycoon on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Who amongst us hasn't dreamed of shaking off the rat race and reinventing a cooler, more tanned version of themselves in some little beachside village? Well, journalist Kate Halfpenny and her husband, Chris Ogue, actually pulled it off. During the pandemic lockdowns, they fled Melbourne in favour of the seaside town of Ocean Grove. But that move, which was meant to bring calm, stirred up something else. Chris's drinking, already a quiet presence in their life, began to take over. And suddenly what was supposed to be a new beginning became a breaking point. Kate writes about this time in her memoir, Boogie Wonderland. Kate Halfpenny and Chris Ogue are both with me this morning. Kate, Chris, welcome.
Good morning, Tegan. Thanks so much for having us.
Good morning, Tegan.
Kate, you said when you first moved during the pandemic, you felt like you were on holiday for the first couple of months, which sounds lovely. When did that start to change?
Yeah, it started to change, Tegan, probably about 3 months in. Before then, we were treating our new house like it was some kind of luxury resort, you know, cocktails in the blow-up Clark Robert pool at 3 PM and boogie boarding every day. It seemed incredible. But after about 3 to 6 months, when reality hits and you know that you have to keep working and you have to mow the lawn instead of just lounging around on it, things started to change. And then we had a terrible upheaval in our life when Chris's brother died, and that brought everything else into sort of stark relief and the holiday was over.
Yeah, that's really awful. That's sort of putting a lot of pressure on. Chris, I'm hearing like cocktails in the pool sounds lovely. Like that is how we spend so much of our holiday time, is alcohol's part of those celebrations. When did that start to shift for you?
I'd say it started the shift, you know, when that first summer came to an end. Winter sets in. We didn't have family or friends down there, and it was just the sense of isolation, boredom. I was probably drinking too much to start with before we moved down, but it just seemed to, you know, gradually creep up. And yeah, then when John died, I just completely spiraled out of control.
Yeah. Do you mind sort of talking to me about what your relationship with booze had been before then? Because as I think we'll get to soon, like Australians have a pretty high tolerance for alcohol, I think, just as at baseline.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I grew up in a house that was just awash with booze. It was a bit of a party house. You know, so when I look at how long I'd been, you know, in effect binge drinking, it's close to 40 years. And my relationship with alcohol was, I thought I was in control. You know, generally speaking, I wouldn't drink Monday to Thursday, but come the weekend, all bets were off. And I'd drink myself stupid. And that was the pattern for literally decades. So it's interesting. Prior to moving down to Ocean Grove, I wouldn't have actually been honest at all in saying that I had a problem with it. But, deep down, like looking back, I did.
Kate, what was your perception at that time? Because alcohol was just kind of a pretty prominent feature of your relationship and how you guys had fun together.
Yeah, Kate, that's right. I mean, I was an absolute willing wingman with Chris's drinking. You know, we both loved it. We loved going to overseas resorts and having happy hour, and we loved splashing each other a wine while we were cooking dinner at night. You know, it made us kind of glittery and fun. And I loved it. I loved drinking with Chris until, you know, I became slowly aware that what had been this sort of welcome third wheel in our relationship had turned into something much grimmer and darker, that I was just constantly worried about. It didn't feel fun anymore. You know, it felt like the party was over, and that we both needed to do some packing up pretty quickly.
So there's a pretty scary moment in the book that was sort of the catalyst, I suppose, for this conversation to start. Kate, do you mind telling me the story?
Yeah, Tegan, we were at the beach one afternoon with my dad, who was then 84 and had two dodgy knees, and he got knocked over in the shallows down at the main surf beach. He's a pretty strong swimmer, so I thought there was no problem, but I'd forgotten that his 84-year-old knees wouldn't let him stand up in the shallows, and I was about 30 metres away watching him, you know, with waves just crashing over his face, and his sort of head was upturned to the sky, but, you know, the water was just smashing him. And I'd been boogie boarding, sort of tossed the boogie board off and started to run, but thought, oh, it's fine. You know, my husband is, he's right there. He can save Dad. But Chris couldn't lift my dad up off the sand. And I'm thinking, what's going on here? It looked like they were doing this sort of clumsy dance together. And I sort of arrived on the scene and pushed Chris off and hauled Dad to his feet, you know, saying, Dad, you've got to help me stand up. Just stand up. And it was like he was suction cupped to the ground. But anyway, I got him up and I was thinking to myself, you know, my husband was, why is he grinning at me as if he's drunk? And then I realised it was because he actually was drunk. So, you know, he'd driven us to the beach drunk, he was in the water drunk, and that was sort of the start for me of thinking, what's going on here? And it was really weird because, I mean, I'm a trained observer of people. That's been my job for a long time. So, you know, It would have made sense if I'd noticed that the one other person who lived with me in a pretty small house was drinking seriously every day, but I didn't notice it. And that's, you know, took Dad home, and that's when we had our first reckoning about it. And I said, you know, this has to change, what's been going on. And that's the point when Chris told me the truth about how his drinking had evolved in the last months.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, and I'm talking to Kate Halfpenny and Chris Ogue, husband and wife, about basically pandemic lockdowns and a sea change that really brought a problem relationship with alcohol to a head. Heather on the Gold Coast has texted in saying, I just realised that alcohol was the indirect cause of all three of my marriages ending, not from excess drinking, but from me quitting drinking. Turns out that not drinking brings out my true introverted character. I've not drunk for years now and I'm happily single in my 60s. That feels like a good ending for Heather's story. Chris, I'm really conscious that we're sort of talking about the probably some of the most embarrassing parts of your life really openly. Kate's written a book about it. We're talking about it on the radio. How does it feel to have your dirty laundry aired in public like this?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. I think, you know, it's our story. It's a huge part of our story together. I'm quite used to being featured in Kate's written work, in her article. So it's not as though I'm completely unfamiliar with the feeling. But it's not a moral failing. It's an illness. I was horribly ashamed of my behaviour, but I don't have that sense of shame anymore. If talking about it is going to help someone feel, you know, less alone or less filled with self-loathing, then to me it's worth it.
Yeah, talking about it as an illness really brings us to the treatment and how hard it was for you guys to find the treatment that Chris needed. You were surprised by this, Kate.
Yeah, it's funny, Tegan. I mean, it's nothing that I'd ever thought about. Oh, I must find a rehab centre for my husband or for anyone else in life that I love. And we were actually lucky that we had health insurance with fantastic extras, because if you don't, you know, I think that the cost at that stage for a 3-week residential stay was about $21,000, and I think that's pretty standard. So, you know, that was the option that we took, the private health route. Even then, we had to wait a couple of months to get into the centre, which was recommended to us, which had sort of both detox facilities and a therapeutic approach, which was what we went for the first time around when Chris opted for rehab. But, my, you know, in researching it, I just was astonished to find out the massive problems that exist when people who don't have private health insurance or the, you know, the financial resources that we were lucky enough to have, you know, it's so hard for people to get into a residential bed. And I just found dozens of stories online, you know, about the crisis in the rehab space, where people are waiting for up to a year to get a bed to help them to get out of this terrible spiral.
And then I've just, you know, you've mentioned it in passing there, Chris, it took more than one go to get this, to get the help that you needed.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it did. I think the first time around, it was about 6 months after John had died, I had to go to a rehab centre in Sydney, and it was very much a model of deprivation. You were completely cut off from everything. You weren't allowed to exercise. You weren't allowed to. You weren't allowed to watch TV, and it was a trauma-based model. And you know, I think it's terrific if it works for you, but for me, it didn't work, and probably because I wanted to keep drinking at that point. I wasn't ready.
And Kate, you're looking at Chris, this person that you love, you know, really wanting the best for them and also your own life. What's going through your head at this moment?
Oh, so much, Tegan. Like anger. I have to say. I was furious with him for a long time. I was devastated. I was sad. I was frustrated. You know, like it's this whole gamut of emotions because basically I was watching our beautiful marriage implode and, you know, watching the man that I loved so much become someone else. Like, I don't know if you've seen that movie. It's one of the Lord of the Rings ones when the king is sort of covered with dust and worms and stuff and he's freed from that and you know, he cracks open that carapace. But, you know, for a long time I felt like Chris was that guy. He was sitting there in this sort of dusty, mouldy shell that he couldn't break out of. But, you know, I have to say it's really important for people to know that, you know, Chris was never violent when he was drinking. He never whizzed through our money. He was never aggressive. He was always really great fun to drink with. And I think that that's why a lot of people get confused about thinking, we didn't know Chris had a problem with alcohol, because to the outside world, he actually didn't. And I think this is the message that I would love to get across to a lot of people, that, you know, we have this stereotypical view that an alcoholic is this old smelly dude drinking from a paper bag on a park bench. But, you know, in reality, it's the middle-aged man with a mortgage and a decent job. He's the one queuing behind you in the MCG members bar, you know, the one who seems fine because he's functioning until he's not. You know, as Chris said, we think about alcoholic as if it's some sort of, you know, moral failing instead of it's really just an illness. But, you know, for me, the issue was that I was seeing firsthand how much silence breeds stigma and how much hiding it makes the problem grow in the dark. And I found it really hard to ring up my best friends and say, Chris is going to rehab, he's an alcoholic, because back then, it's only, what, I don't know, a couple of years ago, not long, but at that point I was one of the people who was seeing alcoholism as having a stigma. I hadn't come around yet to that space of thinking it's like cancer or it's like diabetes, it's an illness and we need to get help for it. It was a really hard time to even admit to myself, let alone anyone else, I'm married to an alcoholic. But, you know, my mantra for Chris was, I'm happy to be married to an alcoholic. I just don't want to be married to a drunk. And that's when we both, you know, realised that he needed to get the help.
Chris, did you feel like the Dusty King? Like, did you see in yourself what Kate was seeing, or were you not there at that point?
I saw it, but I didn't want to acknowledge it. You know, the effect that it was having on Kate, the effect that it was having on my health. I mean, you know, a lot of alcoholics say it, but I was highly functioning. I had a great job. That was probably the only thing that I could focus on, that I could do well. Everything else was just falling to bits, and I knew it was happening. I couldn't face it.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National with me, Tegan Taylor, Kate Halfpenny and Chris Ogar, speaking with such frankness about Chris's struggles with alcoholism that really sort of came to a head during the pandemic. And so many beautiful texts on the text line. Rosie says, Chris and Kate, thank you for your bravery in sharing this story with such frankness. I have no doubt it will help people in similar circumstances. And what a beautiful love story. You're to be commended. So I think we'd better talk about, like, the reason we're having this conversation today with such frankness and self-awareness on your part is because you have managed to navigate through this realization and then this difficulty in finding treatment to get the treatment. Tell me, Chris, about getting to the point where you were ready and getting the treatment that you needed.
So, Tegan, that was roughly 2 years after the first attempt at rehab. So it was only, I think, February last year. I was worried that I was going to die. I couldn't actually live with myself putting Kate through any more of what I'd put her through. Everything was going to fall apart, and I was ready. I knew it had to stop. I didn't want to die.
So you went to rehab, it it stuck, I suppose, this time? Was it about the treatment itself, or was it about your mindset, or was it both?
It was both. It was both. It was again a rehab clinic in Sydney, and it was another 3-week stay. But after you'd done your initial detox on truckloads of Valium, you were allowed to go out for a couple of hours a day if you behaved yourself. You could go out for 6 hours on the weekend. You could work. You could make calls. It was great to still be connected. It was much more of a science-based model than a trauma-based model of rehab. It was that, and that hitting nearly 54 at that point, had 2 birthdays in rehab. I knew it had to stop, and I wanted it to stop.
Kate, you've written about it in your book. You think that we need to rethink our relationship with alcohol as a nation. What kind of conversations would you like to have, would like people to be having with each other and with themselves?
Oh, that's such a great question, Tegan. I mean, I think that I want people to know that being an alcoholic does not reduce people, especially with my beautiful Chris. I think that what he has been through, his alcoholism gives him insight. He's hardly a crusader, but he wants people to understand that addiction doesn't discriminate and that recovery starts with honesty, not hiding. So, telling this story isn't about airing dirty laundry. It's about replacing shame with understanding and replacing silence or ignoring the issue with connection and acceptance and help. And, this is such a universal story that we have. Everyone listening today will have people in their life, and maybe it's actually, them that they suspect are struggling with alcohol. And they're scared of feeling judged or about that stigma to actually admit it. I mean, I get it. If we look just at the pandemic narrative, it's astonishing that I think it was between January 2019 to the end of 2021, alcohol sales in Australia jumped by 29%. Everyone was medicating with booze, and that pandemic pick-me-up was approved of by the government. I still find it so bizarre to think that we couldn't go and walk on the beach with our family, but we could go off to a bottle shop and get on it every night. That sort of really normalised the role that alcohol plays in our lives. And I personally find it, I wish that the conversation was more honest. I wish that more people would look at it as an illness rather than as a dirty little secret. And I wish that there was more government money and government money given, government attention given to this issue, given the great potential that alcohol has to cause harm in people's lives. I think there's something crazy like 14 million interactions at hospitals every year due to issues with alcohol, whether it's heart disease or stroke or diabetes or whether it's domestic violence. It's actually astonishing if you can compare that to something like motor neurone disease, which is such a cruel, hideous disease, and I'm so loving every dollar that is raised for that disease, which is millions and millions a year. But at any time, there's less than 3,000 Australians per year who have motor neurone disease, compared to the hundreds of thousands, probably millions of us, who have trouble with alcoholism. For me, that's just astonishing, and I wish that there was more of a spotlight turned on it, but a non-judgmental spotlight.
Chris, what do you hope people take away from your story?
I guess just a sense of hope. When I say that if I can do it, anyone can, I actually mean that. I'm so lucky to have Kate, who's just loved me so hard. I think the important thing is that, unlike people with other illnesses, who are desperate and crying for help and will tell you straight away, alcoholics won't do that. So it comes down to those that love them and their friends to help them, to jump in and help them.
Chris, Kate, thank you both so much for sharing so openly today, Kate Halfpenny and Chris Ogue. And thank you for your stories as well. Another Chris says, I went through a similar thing with my wife. The stigma must stop. It's the biggest problem. Another person says, my experience is that came down to a choice between my alcoholism or my marriage. At that time, I didn't have enough self-esteem to stop on my own. I have my husband to thank for leading me to discover the real reason why I was self-medicating with alcohol. If this story has raised issues for you or you want to seek more help, you can call the National Alcohol and Other Drug Hotline. The number is 1-800-250-015, 1-800-250-015. Well, coming up next here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, a story about a woman who calls herself a reproductive refugee.
She was every student's favourite teacher.
She would joke around with us, more like a friend than a teacher.
And I remember her saying to me that this is not goodbye, this is see you later kind of thing.
Well, if Ali is able to open up to somebody, that's a good thing.
But what began as a tension became something else.
She was brainwashing us from the start.
The Favourite, a five-part investigation into the cost of silence. Available now. Search Background Briefing on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
There are around 20,000 babies born in Australia and New Zealand each year who are conceived through assisted reproductive technology. My next guest, like many other Australian women, underwent in vitro fertilisation or IVF, but her path to parenthood has been anything but smooth. After freezing her eggs several years ago, she learned she was unable to use them in her home state. She says she was forced to become a reproductive refugee, cross the country to access medical care that she needed to become a mum. And it's an experience she says was profoundly traumatic. And she's sharing her story to highlight what she says is every woman's right to access IVF, regardless of the circumstances. The guest has chosen to remain anonymous, so we'll call her Jane. Jane, welcome to Life Matters. Can you tell me the story of how you came to become pregnant? Because it's a pretty unorthodox one. Your story started when you decided to freeze your eggs 4 years ago. What went into that decision?
So I am a professional woman in my 30s. So at the time, I was still unsure whether I did want to have children or not. But to give my future self a little bit of choice, I decided to freeze my eggs.
And do you mind telling me what that process was like? What's involved in that?
Sure. So it was a lot more involved than I anticipated. It's actually most of the stages of IVF. So you have to inject yourself with lots of different hormones. You undergo so many blood tests to track your cycle that you feel like a human pincushion. And you have so many intravaginal ultrasounds that you're probed to within an inch of your life. And then the procedure itself, this is not the case for all women, but for me, it was incredibly painful. So I experienced a lot of post-operative pain after the eggs were collected. And I also experienced some side effects from the overstimulation. So all the hormones you take to stimulate your ovaries to produce more eggs than normal.
So you've made that decision, you've gone through that process, you've paid for that service, and then you went back to the clinic last year because you were like, yes, I do want to have a baby as a solo mum using donor sperm. What happened then?
So I was assuming at that point that they'd frozen my eggs and that if I went back to that clinic, I could use those eggs to undergo IVF. But to my shock and surprise, the fertility specialist told me that under WA legislation, I was not eligible to access my own eggs and use them for the final stages of IVF. And that's because I was not classified as, in inverted commas, subfertile. So I had elected to become a solo mum by choice. So it wasn't due to a reproductive health problem that I wanted to undergo IVF. But I thought, as I was by that stage in my late 30s, that my reproduction capacity will have decreased due to age and I would be able to access IVF. But that was not the case. I also have another health condition which I thought may reduce my fertility and make me eligible. But again, I was not considered subfertile enough under the legislation and was unable to access the treatment in my home state.
What options were given to you at that time?
So the only option within WA that was offered to me was to undergo several rounds of intrauterine insemination. So that still involves all those hormone injections, the cycle tracking and the ultrasounds. So it would still cost thousands of dollars per round, but it has a very low success rate. So at the age I was at that time, the success rate was probably estimated to be 10 to 15% per round versus an estimated success rate for IVF of around 40%. So in other words, they were trying to force me to undergo several rounds of treatment, which they knew was not going to be very successful, and deny me access to IVF, which they knew might be more successful. So I considered that option and I thought that's really not ideal to me and not exactly ethical, because they were blocking access to my own eggs, they were withholding access to treatment which they knew was more effective, and most importantly, it was just denying me basic bodily autonomy and reproductive freedom. So I had to go for the only other option available to me, which was to seek treatment interstate.
So you did find a doctor in another state who was willing to help you?
So that in itself was a challenge, Tegan, because the clinic in WA indicated to me that they would only transfer my eggs to another fertility clinic interstate that was part of the same chain of clinics. So firstly, I was limited in my choice there, but I was lucky enough that a fertility specialist in another state for the same clinic, the same chain of clinics, was willing to help me. They said my case was too legally sensitive for them to take it, so they referred me to their clinical director, who was one of the most senior fertility specialists in that state, if not Australia. And fortunately, that specialist was willing to take the professional risk to assist me to bypass the WA laws. I was told by the clinic here to keep it very quiet because they couldn't be seen to be aiding and abetting someone to bypass the laws. And if it was on any of my records, they might block the transfer of my eggs. That was really harrowing. But somehow this interstate specialist just was able to negotiate with the director of the clinic here to basically hostage release my eggs so that I could undergo IVF interstate.
You're listening to Life Matters on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor and I'm talking to a woman we're calling Jane, who says she was blocked from using her own frozen eggs in her home state to undergo IVF to become a solo mum by choice. One person says what's involved in IVF and freezing eggs is lots and lots of dollars, no doubt at all. Peter says, why on earth wasn't she told this before her eggs were frozen? Appalling. Jane, did you know that this might be a hurdle that you'd have to overcome?
So they did mention that the WA legislation made IVF available only to people considered subfertile. But to me, it's a question of what do you consider subfertile, firstly. Obviously, our fertility as women declines as we age. And secondly, it's a matter of freedom of access to healthcare. So all women, regardless of their circumstances, should be free to access IVF. And so I assumed that by the time it came to the point where I would want to access my eggs, that we would have that freedom.
Jane, I'd love you to just hang on for a moment, but I want to bring Stephen Page, who's the director of Page Proven Family and Infertility. Sorry, Page Proven Family and Fertility Lawyers, into the conversation. Stephen, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Tegan.
So this is something that you're looking at across Australia all the time as part of your work. Why was Jane told she couldn't use her frozen eggs in WA?
Because WA law says for a single woman to access her eggs, the doctor has to assess that she is unable to conceive a child due to medical reasons. And the Western Australian legislation is quite clear that if you act outside your licensing conditions, then you can lose your the clinic can lose its WA license, the clinician can commit an offence. So doctors met with that clear legislative overview, act conservatively. Now, no other state has this problem. It's just WA.
Why is it different in other states?
Well, every state has its own laws concerning IVF. Somehow, as a nation of 27 million people, we have eight systems. And the Fertility Society, and by way of disclosure, I'm secretary of the Fertility Society as well, but we've called for national uniform laws regarding IVF. So hopefully this problem can't continue. And this came about, ironically, this came about, this restriction 20 years ago to allow single women to access IVF. And it was part of a gay and lesbian law reform at the time. So what was enabling and fit for purpose in 2002 is now restrictive and archaic. Back in 2002, no one was thinking about egg freezing. It was just, it just wasn't part of the conversation. And now, of course, it's common. And as Jane has said, we should all be entitled to bodily autonomy and reproductive freedom.
So the legalities involved in Jane moving her frozen eggs interstate, we heard her say that the clinics were skittish about it, not sure whether they would be breaking the law by doing that. What do we know about the law here?
Well, number one, Jane's the owner. Number two, there's no, under the Constitution, you have freedom of interstate trade, commerce and intercourse. And number three, in Western Australia, there are restrictions about moving donor eggs, donor sperm and donor embryos. You need permission of the Reproductive Technology Council. These eggs, her eggs, were not donor eggs, so she had full freedom to move them.
So other than going interstate to access IVF, which is what Jane has done, are there other options? Could she have challenged the law in her home state?
Not on the face of it. It's a valid law in Western Australia. Western Australia has talked for some time now about replacing this law and the Surrogacy Act in Western Australia. The government said prior to the election that it was going to bring in a bill to replace both. We haven't seen that bill yet. Hopefully that happens soon.
So there is change perhaps on the horizon. Is there a concerted push to change this?
Certainly on the part of the Fertility Society, there's a push to change it. We've got Greg Hunt and Rachel Swift to carry out a wide-based community consultation. The Federal Health Minister has said that regulation of IVF should be part of the national conversation now, so hopefully that will happen soon.
And we did reach out to WA Health for a comment on this, and they haven't yet responded to our request for comment. Jane, I'd love to come back to you. You've had so much going on. Why was it important for you to share this story?
So firstly, it's to urge the WA government to really make updating these laws a priority. People can't afford to wait months or years. That could be the difference between them becoming parents or not. And also, and I'm going to try not to get too emotional when I say this, but I found out that I am having a daughter. And so it really is important to me that she grows up and she has bodily autonomy and reproductive freedom, because these laws can't persist. And women need to have choice over their own bodies. The only person who should have a say over if you can try to have children or if you don't want children is you.
Jane, oh my gosh, thank you so much for sharing that. It's Thanks. Very, very moving to hear you speak about that, speak about your little girl in that way. What changes would you like to see happen between now and the time that your daughter might be looking to have kids?
So in the specific instance of access to assisted reproduction, it should be open to solo parents by choice, gay singles and couples, widows, women who have survived domestic violence, who still want to have kids but outside a partnership. All these people may not have reproductive health problems or be considered subfertile, but they still deserve access to healthcare, to reproductive healthcare.
Thank you so much, Jane. You were forced to become a reproductive refugee. She left her home state to access IVF and fulfil her dream of becoming a mum in her late 30s. And you also heard from Stephen Page, a family and fertility lawyer. That is it for Life Matters Today here on ABC Radio National, coming to you from Jagera and Turrbal land. Today's show was all about family relationships, something a lot of us are no doubt focusing on as we navigate the holiday season. And tomorrow we'll take a look behind the curtain of secretive extremist subcultures and how you can get help if you fear that a loved one is falling victim to radicalisation. You can catch up on any of the stories from today or any episode of Life Matters on the ABC Listen app. I'll catch you tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.